All right, good afternoon, everybody. If it's Tuesday at 1 o'clock, it must be Tuesdays with Dave. So I want to welcome everybody to the call today. I want to welcome our new mastery members from a couple of different cities around the United States that were at events for the last couple of weeks. I also want to welcome those of you that are watching on live stream. Welcome to you as well. In the next hour or so, this is an open line, open mic. Ask any questions you'd like. You can ask questions about real estate. You can ask questions about life. I've got a lot of experience in both. So to open up, let's talk about what happened 2 weekends ago. Ultimate Partnering 9. Ultimate Partnering 9 was huge. We had just under 1,000 people there. There was great networking that happened. We had a great speed networking. People got to meet their targets right in the morning of the first day. It was some really good education. I talked about the 8 disciplines of how to scale a multifamily real estate business. Eric Stewart was in on how to negotiate term sheets with banks. We had an attorney in talking about crowdfunding. We had Bob Bowman in talking about underwriting. We had most of our faculty there, and there was just a lot of good information being shared. There was a lot of fun happening, and it was crazy. It was a crazy 3 days. I know a lot of participants didn't get a lot of sleep. There was so much networking going on. And it was beautiful weather in Boston as well. So looking forward to Ultimate Partnering 2018, which is going to happen on the weekend after Labor Day next year. We're actually switching it for the first time out of August into September. So, good. If you were there, let us know what you thought when you're calling in. So to get onto the queue, you want to call, you want to press *0. *0 will get you into the queue. The operator is going to ask you your name, and then she will call you onto the call, and you can fire away with your questions. Before we get started, let's give a high five to Brian Adams from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His first deal was a 276-unit property in Tennessee for $4.5 million. He then did a 144-unit in South Carolina for $10.3 million. His next deal was a 209-unit in Texas for $6 million that appraised at $7.4 on the day of the purchase. He just purchased 556 units and was able to raise $10 million in 45 days. Brian Adams from Philadelphia, if you are listening, if you could call in, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about the deals that you're doing. But you get a high five onto his fourth deal. Awesome. I got a bunch of questions that were emailed in, and I will go through a couple of those as people are queuing up. Do I have operator on the line? Waiting for the operator.
Hi, Dave. This is the operator.
Hi, operator. Okay, good. So we have an operator on the line. We do have people queuing up for questions. It's the summertime. Usually the summer times are a little bit slow for questions. Not that the people that are asking the questions are slow. It's just that slow for questions. But the first one comes in from Rosemary Dean. This one was emailed in. She's from New York and says, by the way, I do believe that the Boston Red Sox are ahead of the New York Yankees in the standings this morning. Just saying, are there any cases where it is possible to do a non-recourse loan for a multifamily acquisition so that you not put your personal assets at risk? Yeah, actually, every deal just about over $1 million is usually a non-recourse loan. Any deal under $1 million a lot of times is a recourse loan. And those deals are usually done by local banks. So once you start getting into Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, it's typically non-recourse. So you don't have to put up your collateral or anything that you own for the property in case the property goes bad. The other thing with the non-recourse or those size deals, what was I thinking? I just lost my train of thought. Oh, it's construction loans. Construction loans will be recourse until they're 85% occupied, or we should call those repositionings. Anything that's below 85% occupancy, which 85% occupancy is what's called equilibrium. So when you get above 85%, then you can get the good financing, the Freddie Mac, the Fannie Mae, the FHA financing, because the property is considered stabilized. When it's below 85% occupancy, it's considered unstable, then you have to go through other forms of financing. It's going to cost you more money until you get it at stabilization, and then you can refinance it and get the good loans. Fannie Mae has a really good program. where they will give you what's called the mezzanine or the bridge financing, and then you can roll it into long-term financing with minimal costs. So you want to look into that if you're doing a repositioning. So in a repositioning, one of the clauses that you always want to have, especially with the local banks inside of your repositioning loans, is that when it hits 85% occupancy, the loan becomes non-recourse. And typically it's 85% occupancy for 3 months or 6 months or more. You try to get it for 3 months. So as soon as it hits 85% occupancy, it becomes a non-recourse loan. So that's the answer to that question. Good question. So this next one is from Pamela Tate Gibson. She's from Chicago, Illinois. She writes in, if I'm analyzing a property and my strike price is 72%, for those of you who aren't familiar with strike price, that is the maximum amount that you will pay for a property. Is 72% of the offer, should I still put in the offer? Absolutely. Why not? If you think it's so low that you need to explain the offer to the broker or the seller, then simply explain the numbers to your seller. A lot of times the justification is the bank's not going to give you financing, you know, based on a higher or much higher purchase price. So what, in your opinion, is the lowest percentage of the offer price should you not put in an LOI? There is no lowest percent of an offer price that you can't put in an LOI, because if you put it in the right way, you're doing two different things when you're putting in a letter of intent, LOI. Number one, you're obviously offering for the property. You're trying to get a discussion that will lead to a negotiation that will lead to an accepted offer to the property, an offer that you can afford to pay. The other thing you're trying to do is establish a relationship with a broker. And a lot of times those initial deals that come to you that you have to put in a low offer aren't the deals that you're going to do with the broker. So you're establishing your relationship with the broker. If you've been to the Multifamily Millions Bootcamp, in the marketing section, we actually have a script there on how to put in a lowball offer. The one thing we never do is shotgun out a bunch of offers out into the world and then, you know, see which one's going to stick. That's not how you create relationships in this business, and this business is a relationship business. The best deals that you're going to get are those deals that you either do direct mail and get talking directly to the seller, or the deals that your brokers are giving you that are pocket listings that nobody else is going to see. So in order to get those pocket listings, you have to establish a relationship. You need to establish commonality. So, all right, I got some more questions. I'll wait till there's a lull in the action before we get to the questions here on a beautiful, and I must say beautiful, it's actually Thursday afternoon in Boston. You know what happens when you do ultimate partnering events? Time stops. And, you know, your idea of what day it is kind of goes out the window for a couple of weeks. Because, you know, that's a lot of work. You know, did you see how hard that staff was working at that event? I mean, without the staff, without our team here, that event does not take place. So they all did great work at that event. So if you happen to be talking to them on the phone, applaud them for what they did if you were there. All right, so I'm going to open up the lines. Who's first? Who's our first caller, operator?
Aaron, please state your question.
Hey.
Aaron?
Hey, Dave. This is Aaron. How are you? Had a wonderful time at Ultimate Partnering. Yeah, you guys put on a great event.
Yeah, you were there.
Yeah, no, it was awesome. It was a great event. We're nursery students. We've been in about 3-4 months, and we were presented with an opportunity to get involved in a $21 million deal that's already under contract, but they're looking for, you know, investors. And we have a couple questions about this situation. One is the $100,000 that they want to put in, they're actually promising to return to us at closing in return for 1% management stake throughout the deal. And this is a micro repositioning as well as a development deal. And the other question is they want the money prior to closing, obviously, but they want the money prior to even releasing the PPM. And we're a little bit concerned about how the order of things normally go.
Do you want the money before you see a copy of the private placement memorandum?
Yeah, they didn't necessarily say they wouldn't wait for the private placement, but they said they're 3 weeks away from that being actually ready, and they're hoping to get the money by next week. That we've seen a ton of other documents that detail everything, but we were just kind of getting your take on, we've never done a deal. Is it unusual to get involved in a deal without seeing the PPM?
Well, no, it is. And I'll tell you what, any attorney, if they found out that they were accepting money prior to the signing of a private placement memorandum, would stop their association with that particular entity, because that is totally against the SEC rules. That's not even a blind pool. That's just accepting investor funds without an agreement. There's got to be an agreement in place before you can accept any funds. And there's been situations in the past where, you know, we have had, you know, we have Kim Taylor teaching our private money event. And I've had other previous attorneys teaching that event. And they have told me it happens, you know, it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen where people will come to them and say that, you know, they've got money already in. The attorney that they contracted to do the SEC work is not getting it done. So they want to do it, you know, with a new attorney. And once the attorney finds out that there's money already in, they're like, nope, can't touch it. Can't touch that. You've already done something wrong. So so that's the first thing that's wrong. The second, I don't understand the, how you're going to get the money back at closing. How are you going to get the money back at closing? That's odd.
Well, yeah, no, we found it to be an odd event too. They said that they're raising enough money to cover earnest money deposit and other things, and that they should have plenty of money extra to, you know, to pay us back basically at closing. They said they've raised 5.5 of a $6 million raise. They're in the last 500,000. Sounds like it's getting a little hard to get the last 500,000, so they're offering increased incentives. So they've already collected $5.5 million, and the PPM is not there.
Well, first of all, it doesn't make sense. If they just need the money for the earnest money deposit and they already have $5.5 million in, how much is the earnest money deposit? I mean, typically that's on a $21 million deal, it's probably about $300,000 to $400,000. And they already have $5.5 million in. Why do they need money for the earnest money deposit? That doesn't make sense. So things aren't making sense here.
So we should be pretty leery before we go further.
I would be very cautious. Very cautious. Yeah.
Okay. That's what we wanted to hear, because we're meeting with them this afternoon again. So we wanted to hear it from the expert first. So I appreciate your help.
Now, don't get me in the middle of anything, but that's I would be very
of course not. Okay. All right. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it.
All right, good luck out there. Anybody, yeah, have something else come up, you feel free to call the office in between these calls. All right, who's next? Who's our next caller?
Up next, we have Jose. Jose, please state your question.
Hi, Dave. Good afternoon. Jose from San Antonio, Texas. How are you?
Hey, Jose, what's going on in San Antonio?
Doing really good, really good weather now. And thank you guys for what you guys, you know, built on the UP9. It was great. It was my first one, and definitely it's going to be the first one of a lot of them. It was a great, great, great experience and motivational as well.
What was the best part of that event for you?
Just the plain networking from day zero, just at the registration, we started on the networking. And for me, that I'm a very introverted person and hard to reach out to strangers, it helped me tremendously cure that and work with that fear. And
thanks for saying that, because I always talk about the fact that if you're an introvert, this is one of the best places you can go to meet people, because
definitely.
That's what it's all about, and everybody knows that. And if you're an extrovert, you love it even more. But yeah,
yeah,
so that's good.
It was great. It was great. So
we did our job.
I'm sorry.
We did our job.
So just wanted to there's some delay on the line, but what I wanted to ask you is a kind of a compounded question. I'm analyzing a property where it cash flow really good, cash flows really good, but the pricing per unit is on the high side for an already existing property. Compounded question is, is it possible to have such property where it cash flows like crazy, but when you do the appraisal for the financing purposes, it doesn't appraise for the asking price? And if that's the case, what happens if you have already the property under an LOI for a higher price than it's appraised for?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense that a property would cash flow very well. Actually, it could, yeah. No, it all depends on what the purchase price is. You know, the purchase price is always a reflection of the net operating income. and then whatever the cap rate is that they're using. So if it's cash flowing great and it's got great NOI, and it's still overpriced, then it's still overpriced.
So for the purposes of the financing, for example, is it possible that if we move on with this at the price they're asking for, or an agreed price, is we're actually going a little lower than the asking price, if we agree to this price, but later on an appraisal says, you know, the property is $300,000, to say a number, $300,000 under the agreed price, what happens there, or what can I do, or what are the options?
You certainly renegotiate. They don't have to renegotiate with you, but you can based on the appraisal and based on your ability to get financing. But let's go back to the NOI, because I just thought of something. So if you've got a property that's cash flowing like crazy, but it's not appraising, then that means that they're either using the wrong capitalization rate on the property, or you've got to be thinking about when you put your new debt service in for the mortgage that you're going to be getting, what's it going to cash flow like then? Because if it cash flows with the new debt service like crazy, then there's something wrong. That deal should appraise out, because the appraisal is based on, you know, the numbers. It's based on the income approach. But if you haven't added the new debt service in, you know, based on that sales price, then you've got to take another look at the deal. Is that the case? Still there? Operator, did I lose Jose?
No, he's still on the line.
Jose, you there? Jose, you having a heart attack? Should we call the 911 in San Antonio?
Okay, now he's been disconnected.
Okay. If he calls back in, put him to the front, would you?
Okay.
All right, who's next?
At the moment, we have no callers with questions.
It is a light summer afternoon. So press star zero if you'd like to get into the queue. Star zero, and you would get to the front of the line. And I am going to – oh, by the way, if you go to davecall.com, you'll see all the things that we offered at Ultimate Partnering 9. And as I explained from the front of the room, typically at that event, it's just all education, and it's all taught by faculty members, and we just assume that you'll hear something and you want to take the next step and you'll invest. But in the past, that wasn't happening. The event was breaking even, and we thought, well, in order for this, we're an education company. In order for this to work, we've got to make revenues. So we decided that at the last 10 minutes of certain presentations, we'd tell which product that this related to. And then I came up with some new products. I came up with this great product called Elevate, which is all about how to transform your business life, your health life, and your family life, which we meet three times a year for 2 days each. First meeting is October. Have another great product called Perfect Your Presentation, which is all about how to present private money presentations to groups of people, wealthy individuals, and you actually get templates of a private money presentation, mine, property packages, and all kinds of great stuff. That's here in Boston in October as well. We came out with just a bunch of new stuff that people were really interested in, and if you want to see those offers, we're going to keep this website up for one more day. It's called davecall.com. You can see what we offered there, and you can get them for that pricing. So, and if you're at the event and you're kicking yourself because you didn't take advantage of one of those opportunities, that website's up for one more day, davecall.com. All right, operator, before you actually go to the next caller, I'm going to read one from Rachel Foodie from Alpharetta, Georgia. This is a long question. She writes in, I'm interested in a 12-unit that a broker told me was operated by a nonprofit that does transitional housing. The tenants live there between 3 to 8 months and don't sign leases. The property is offering 2-year rent guarantees of $8,100 with a nonprofit would, in essence, be the tenant through a master lease. As the owner, we would be responsible only for taxes and insurance. The nonprofit would do all of the property management. The broker is telling me that the place is always 100% occupied. Okay. Alex just came in and told me I got to turn the mic a different way. So she goes on to say that the broker is telling me that the place is always 100% occupied. My question for you is, does this sound like a good investment or should I just move on? Well, I would not let them manage the property. I would allow them to continue bringing tenants in and out if you decided to do this deal. The guaranteed of, 2 years rent of $8,100, that looks like a positive. They're transitional tenants, so you've got to know who's coming in and out. When you say transition, what are they transitioning in and out of? That's the question. What type of wear and tear are they putting on the property? Because they are transitional. How many people are they putting in there? Is it at code? You know, are they following the current city codes to make sure that the whole house doesn't get shut down because they're not following those codes, which is common in these types of properties? So there's a lot of questions to still ask, but the biggest one is do not give over management of your property and don't let other people put people in that who you don't know. So if you decide you want to do this deal, I would work with that management company. I would look at the types of people that they're bringing in, you know, and I would look at the criteria that they're using for determining whether or not that person can stay at the property. And then I would tweak that criteria to your liking. And I would do this prior to the deal, by the way, because who knows, if you tweak it too much and they might not be able to get those tenants in and therefore you've got an empty house. So I don't know. It's a deal that has a lot of questions. I haven't seen one quite like this before. So tread softly, ask a lot of questions. All right, operator, let's go to the next caller. Who's next on the list?
Okay, I have Jose back on the line. Jose, please go ahead.
Jose, what happened?
Hi, Dave. I don't know. Something on my side that I muted it or something and I lost it, but apologies for that.
No problem.
So going back to it, I was always under the impression that, or I didn't know, that does the appraisal takes also 100% of the financials as well, and it has a physical side plus the financial side on it to determine the appraised price, or just the physical?
The appraiser is going to look at the income, the financials mainly, and then they'll look at the replacement value, but they determine the loan amount usually off of the income calculations.
Okay. Then that will answer my question. I thought it was mostly on the physical, on the dwelling part. Not only the financials.
Okay, that's what makes it so good, this business, because your properties can qualify for a bank loan when you don't.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Good luck.
Thanks.
Albert, who's next?
Up next, we have Lynn. Lynn, please state your question.
Yeah. Hi, Dave. Happy belated birthday from Baltimore.
Hey, thank you very much. It was a great day yesterday.
That's good. Yeah, I got your Twitter on that. I'm glad you had a good day. And thanks for UP9. It was my first
day.
Yeah, I saw the lobster, so it made me jealous. But thanks for UP9. It was a great event. You guys did a class A deal there. Just wish I could have taken advantage of some of the things, but I do see where you put the offers up. So I'm going to do what I can to take advantage of those offers. My question has to do with how I structured a deal. Now, when I have a 6-unit that I'm looking at, and the offer, the present owner has six tenants in there on month to month. Okay, so, and the property needs a lot of TLC. So what I've done is I've actually, I'm sorry?
Did you say it was a six unit and everybody's on month to month?
It's a six unit. Yes, yeah, a six unit.
Right.
And everybody's on a month to month. Has a lot of deferred maintenance, needs a lot of TLC. So I've looked at it as repositioning. But what I've done is I've taken his asking price and I've kind of cut it down by half. And then I've offered him an earnout over 18 months. So what I said is, okay, I'm not giving him I'm still not giving him his whole price. We're still at like 75% of his price, because even after the earnout and the lease up, I'm still not making the Trinity. So I know that he didn't accept that, but he's coming back with a counteroffer. But I wanted to just kind of hold to my price because what I've looked at is the money I need to put in for the repositioning also. So I guess my question is, what's your experience of using an earnout as a way to get in the property and then reposition it?
Never saw it attempted before in all my years of doing this. I know
it's
done in business all the time, and I've seen those. Yep, I've seen those on a regular basis, but never in a multifamily property. So kudos for you for thinking outside the box.
Yeah, because I figured I can get in there, because right now, just to give you an idea, he has people in there on a month-to-month at approximately $800 a month, okay? The comp in the area for the same size with a little bit of upgrade, it's like $1,350. So that's where the idea of the earnout, definitely. So I figure I can get away with it for about $15 a door to bring it up. Bring it up. And then the earnout I offered him was that after rehab, we get 6 months to lease up and then a year to stabilize. And then he gets his additional money. Because I figured going back for a refi, they're going to want to see a stabilized property before they would refi it. So I would refi it at the new value, and then give him back.
What's his feedback? What does he say?
Well, I don't think he understands it too much. I think he's taken a lot of time to look at it. The broker thinks it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Because it has a lot of deferred maintenance, and there's a big upside potential to it.
There's a huge upside. I mean, this deal, I would be all in on this deal. I mean, $1,500 a door, that's cheap to get a 500.
Yeah, I said 1,500 and then 15,000.
Oh, 15,000? That's a big difference.
Yeah,
right,
it is. That's why I corrected it.
Yeah.
But still, even then, because what I'm looking at as the upside is rehab the kitchen, rehab the bathroom, flooring and paint everywhere else. And I think I'm still on the high side at 15,000 a door.
Yep.
That's for me walking around Home Depot saying, okay, do this, do that. So I still think I'm on the high side for that.
I think, you know, in order for – so he owns a free and clear, is that it?
He owes it free and clear, and he's motivated because his loan's coming due.
Wait a minute. How can he own it free and clear if his loan's coming due?
Oh, I'm sorry. When I said free and clear, yeah, it is under a mortgage.
How much is the asking price, and how much is the mortgage? Or how much is the mortgage?
He's asking for $650,000. His mortgage, I think, is in the 400 range.
So you're gonna have to at least pay off the amount of the mortgage, unless he's gonna come to the closing with money, right?
Right.
What's your plan there?
Well, my plan, that's where I think I'm waiting for the counteroffer, because my plan was to offer him $335,000.
Yeah.
And with the earned up only took him to $650,000. I'm sorry. Took him up to $650,000. Mm. So we still left something on the table at the end.
You're going to have to cover that mortgage. Do you know that this guy's a wealthy guy? I mean, what's his incentive for coming to the table with money, the closing table with money?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Well, you're going to have to create one, because otherwise he's not going to do it. And then that's number one. Number two, do you know if he has the money to come to closing? And number three, if you're not sure on either of those, you got to at least cover the amount of the mortgage at closing.
Right.
You know, and then what you do after that, you can do your earn out, you can do a second mortgage, seller financing, seller equity participation. There's a lot of different things you can do. But yeah, I think you've got to cover that first, and then if you're gonna do the earn out, I mean, you really gotta explain it and dumb it down as much as possible, because as soon as they get confused, they're gonna say no. You know, so you've gotta really make it as easily to understand as possible to have the potential of getting it done.
Well, I had put the details in the LOI explaining how the earnout works.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking.
Is it really simple? No technical language, sixth grade level, all that?
It's real simple. It says, you know, I gave them.
Simple for you, you know what? You should have somebody else read it and say, can you understand this? Somebody
okay.
that's not in real estate. Yeah, that
Got
would be
it.
A good thing to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Good luck with that one. Let us know how you do.
I certainly will. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. All right. Oh, by the way, there is for Ultimate Partnering 2018, there is an early bird special going on right now. It's not at the lowest price that you could get if you were at the event, but it's at the next lowest price that it will ever be until it gets up to $1,500 like it did last year. And you can find that on DaveCall.com as well, DaveCall.com. So if you're listening and you're trying to figure out what this Ultimate Partnering event is all about that people are talking about, I can just tell you it was awesome. Each person that's called in that has been there has said it's been awesome. And Ultimate Partnering 2018 at the lowest price possible is on DaveCall.com. It's where you're going to want to be. All right, I'm going to answer a question from John Cornish from Philadelphia. As more people get on the line, press star zero, and you will be next on the Wisecracker line. I've been in real estate for 10 years, John Cornish from Philadelphia writes. He says, I started and stopped because of the crash of 2007-2008. I was just talking about that crash in a meeting a little while ago. I just got back in business and attended your boot camp and eventually joined the mastery program. Good for you. My question is, what do you come across as being easier, finding money or finding deals? Both of them require relationship building. So once you get good at relationship building or at least go through the process and understand how to build a relationship, that's how you will get more deals and that's how you get people to invest in your deals. People think they can send out postcards to a big list and then, you know, people will call them up with money. It doesn't work that way. Even at the Ultimate Partnering 9, where there was millions and millions of dollars in that room that was looking to invest in real estate, most of the people that had money weren't telling people. You know, they were waiting to get to know people. People will not do business with you unless they like you first and think they can trust you second. So you get that like and trust from relationship building. So raising private money, when I took the whole company here to an event over at Harvard that was entitled How Businesses Fail, they went through a list of different reasons why businesses fail, but they said the number one reason that businesses fail is that the CEO or the owner could not raise funds for the business, had an inability of raising funds. So it's really a skill set that you need to know. That's why we're doing the private money presentation or perfect your presentation pitch. That's why we have private money bootcamp and the private money home study system. But it's a skill set, even if you're not a good networker like I'm not, if you're an introvert like I am and like the caller had stated earlier, there are certain steps and techniques that you use that get you there. And it's all about relationship building. So which one is easier? For me, actually, it's easier as finding deals because it's relationship building as well. But you go in with the knowledge of a market. You go in with – actually, you know what? I can't say that one is easier than the other. I can tell you one thing. You probably feel a lot more butterflies in your stomach when you're looking to take other people's money and put it into a deal because you're responsible for that. And you're responsible for performing. And not all deals work out. That's the thing. That's when people sign the private money private placement memorandum, when I got my first one that I was giving to investors, it basically said that you know that real estate is risky and you could lose some or all of your money. It said it in bold print on every single page. And I threw it back to the attorney and I said, hey, I said, you got to change that language. Nobody's going to invest in my deals. And he said, with that language in there, and he said, you know what? The investors that have been investing before will because they understand how the game is played and they understand that language. And those that don't, you have to tell them that real estate is risky and that they could lose some or all of their money, which is true. So you need to tell them that. And so that's where the biggest butterflies come from. It just seems a little bit easier to get the deals. But you really need to be good at both. But of the two, the acquisitions part of it, the getting the deals, you can train somebody to do that. You can have a whole acquisitions team out there. The raising of the funds is something that you got to be good at. All right, John, good question. All right, who's next? Operator? Did you know that you should be eating 4 fruits a day? 2 salads, 1 yogurt, 1 banana. I read that in Dr. Furman's book, Eat to Live. It's not too hard to do either. All right, who's next?
Okay, up next we have Mark. Mark, please state your question.
Hey, Dave, Mark Dupuy from Ottawa, Ontario. How you doing?
Hey, Mark, what's going on up there in Ottawa?
Not bad, not bad. Question I have for you, I guess it sort of talks to a little bit what you were just talking about the relationship building. We've started a meetup now. We're probably in our 3rd month, and we're starting to get some pretty good traction, actually. We've got about 100, just a little over 100 people now that are signed up for our local meetups here. So I'm kind of trying to figure out the line between selling and educating. I'm trying to keep it really clear that when we're at the meetup, it's really educational, but I don't want it to just be educational. You know what I mean? I want there to be, like, I don't know if I should be trying to push them to something else or.
What do you want to tell them?
I don't know. Sorry?
What do you want to sell them?
Well, I want to start selling them on a deal, right? Start seeing if
into
they're interested in it. Investing.
You should be doing that from the beginning, and you should be letting them know that that you yourself are an investor. That's why you started up the meetup group, and you're always looking for investors to participate in your deals. And if anybody wants to sign up. For your deals, to see your deals when they come in, sign this accredited investor form. We'd be happy to get them on the list. And you do that spiel every week, and then you talk about, you give an update of, what market you might be in or what you might be looking at or, give a brief update after that. And you haven't violated really, any of the protocols. You've got a pre-existing relationship and you're not trying to make an offer. And then when you do have an offer, you've got a list. And you email that list because they've all signed your form. You email that list specifically, and do a presentation, like a webinar type presentation.
Okay, and is it? I know there's a lot of talk about just accredited investors, but I think for our first one, we're trying to get a deal done. So if we come across, is it possible to do deals with non-accredited?
Non-accredited? Yeah, SEC says you can't have more than 35 non-accredited investors in a deal, Regulation D. So you can't have more than 35, and you shouldn't have more than 35 anyways. But yeah, you can do it with non. The thing is, it's the risk factor. Number one, the disclosures are a lot higher. And then the risk of if the deal goes bad and them coming back and trying to get you, they have a higher chance of getting at you, your personal assets, if a deal goes bad, because they weren't accredited. That's all. That's the difference. But yeah, you can do it with anybody. You can put anybody in your deals. You don't want to. But most of us start out by putting a combination of sophisticated and accredited investors in deals. And then, as you do more deals and you make more money and you get more investors, then you when you can, you switch to only accredited investors.
Yeah, and that's what I think we want to do as well. It's just we're not at that point right now. So that's why I was hoping that we could do something with non-accredited. So we could do something with strictly all non-accredited investors. Okay.
Yeah, you at least want them to be sophisticated.
Right.
If you can get them to be sophisticated, that would be good. But even then, the people that are least sophisticated are usually your friends and family.
Yeah, I've explored the friends and family thing already and didn't raise anything. So we're at the meetup.
That's okay.
We're at the meetup.
Yeah, that's okay. They're usually the hardest people to deal with in your deals.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I missed that last piece that you said.
Now, I was going to say the problem is with your relatives is they're still going to be relatives after the deal if the deal goes bad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're still going to have to see them. They probably won't talk to you when you see them, but you're still going to have to see them. You know, here's the other thing, you know, I get the most feedback from students when dealing with their relatives, and that is they're the ones that give them the hardest times about their acquisition fees, you know, the amount that you get for your acquisition fees for doing the deal. It's your relatives that give you a difficult time with that. But so what else is on your mind?
Remember that deal I spoke to you about, I don't know, probably 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, was that low income housing one? And the guy keeps coming back to me. So I'm kind of like, I've analyzed it from the start, and we're at our dollar amount that we've been at from the start. And he keeps coming back, and he seems to be, this last round that he's coming back to me seems to be that he wants to kind of, he's exploring the number that we've basically put at him from the start. The way I underwrote it, I basically said, because it's a little bit different than a typical, you know, straight up cash flowing deal, I basically did, instead of trying to get a 20% averaged out year over year return, I put in 30.
Do you
think that's going to get the deal done?
What was the initial problem with the deal in the first place, other than low income housing? Refresh my memory.
It's a low income housing. It's got 2 years left on his initial 15 years. So we basically are buying his entity, and we're sliding into his position. He slides out. In 2 years, the mortgage is paid off, and then we have to do a year of song and dance for the IRS to be able to get out of this low income, and then we're basically free and clear to do whatever we want. We go to market rents. So
it's not the IRS that you're in contract with for low income.
No. Well, it's an IRS program that's administered by the Kentucky Housing, but it's an IRS program. But you're right.
Kentucky Housing Authority. No, the IRS doesn't have anything to do with housing.
Right.
The Kentucky Housing Authority certainly does.
Right. So we'd have to do a year of stuff with them to get it out of the low income. So I see
it's a lot of paperwork.
Sorry?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I see probably 5 years, you know, until the 2 years of the low income, brings us to the end of our 15-year term, and then, you know, prepping and finally doing the year of Kentucky Housing stuff. And then once they finally kind of greenlight us, you got to get those rents up, right? So I see a year and a half of that. So I see
once they greenlight you, get the, how many units is it?
53 units.
Yeah, you're going to lose the majority
total
of those tenants.
Buildings.
You're going to have to re-tenant them.
Yeah. And so that's what I'm saying.
They're all on vouchers. There's a delay on this line. Operative, if you could take this delay off the line, that would make these conversations a lot easier. Thank you. You're going to lose all – you got to be prepared to lose all of those – most of those tenants. Once – you know, they all probably have vouchers, low-income vouchers. So you're going to have to bring it to market in order to maximize your return on this property. So you've got 2 years of maintaining, you've got 1 year of transition, and then you've got another year of very low cash flow because of this transition. Because you know what's going to happen is, and this is going to be even more difficult getting. It's a difficult turnaround, but if you can do it, you're going to make a ton of money. But the other difficulty you're going to face is the people that are going to pay market rent are not going to want to initially come into that property because it's known as a low-income housing property. The perception out in the marketplace is already there. So you're going to have to change the name, do something different, and still, you know, the first few people coming in, they'll probably come in, you should probably do 6 month rent, you know, so below market rents, not as low as a low-income housing, but at least below what's out there in the market. So you can start bringing them in so they can start telling the people in the neighborhood and the community that that things have changed over there. It's not that type of property anymore, and that will help you change the perception. But let's go back to your original point of 30% annualized return, and that's going to make the deal work. Isn't there a number where what's the offer right now? What's he asking?
He's asking $35 a door.
All right. So what's it worth based on today's cash flow?
$22.5 a door.
Oh my God! How's he asking 35? How's he justifying that?
I don't know. He just that's what he wants, and that's what he wants. I don't think he understands kind of what the mark, you know, what the value is. Like every time I talk to him about one building, he just said, "Well, you know, this one building is completely concrete. It's gonna last forever." I'm like, "I don't care. I'm just looking at the numbers.
No, it's numbers. Everything's based on
yeah.
numbers."
Exactly.
It sounds like he's way out of the ballpark. I mean, why? I wouldn't even spend any more time with it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not. It's just he keeps coming back to me. So.
Oh, he's coming back to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only reason that this thing is still alive, because when we first analyzed it,
is he lowering his price?
Sorry.
Is he lowering his price?
Yep, he's slowly but surely coming down. Every time he comes back. And this final one was like, I
where's
told
he at now?
There's, he's still at 35, but when, so there's two buildings. There's 29 in one building and 24 in the other building. And I analyzed them separately. And on the one building, he's getting higher rents. And so that one there, we could do 35. But when he came back to me, he said, look, let's just talk about this one building for now. Let's talk. And he was talking about the lower one. And that lower one was, like I said, it was at 22.5. I said, Tony, I can't pay more than 22.5. He says, I can't do 22.5. So when he and the broker got to talking, the broker said, look, what about 25 for all of them? So like I said, I was prepared to pay 35 for the other building. And he's like, look, if you're going to do 25, you have to do 25 for all units. So that's kind of where he's at right now. He's kind of, I think he's ready to come to the table with 25 per unit.
All right,
like I said, I'm just trying to make sure
that
30% annualized return is going to do it for investors. Like, I don't want to start, I don't want to get this thing on a contract like that and then start going out.
35 is huge.
To raise
I mean, investors are looking for anywhere from 16 to 20.
Okay. And I think it's going to be higher than 30 as well, because I came up with a price with that number in mind. But like I said, he said, look, let's do 25 for all units. One building was 22.5 is what my max number was. And the other one was 35. So the one at 35, if we're getting them for 25, there's going to be some extra returns there. So I'm pretty confident. I mean, I know the numbers are solid. I mean, the buildings, he's done a really good job of keeping, look, those buildings are beautiful, like granite countertops. They're beautiful. But it's just that low income housing that's done. So you think 30 will do the trick. People won't be shying away from it. Got that kind of.
Yeah. You're basing that off a 5-year pro forma. Yeah, the problem you're going to have is when you show them that middle year. I'm not sure how you're calculating that middle year, but that middle year is going to be difficult. Year three, when you go from transitioning from low income to market rent.
Low income, yeah.
Yeah, because you're going to
have
your probably occupancy is going to drop to like 50%
yep.
for a while. You got to take that into consideration.
I've allowed for, I think it was 18 months. Maybe it was even 2 years, I think, maybe to transition it over from the low income to the final.
At what occupancy?
I can't remember exactly now. I can't remember if I kind of staggered it sort of, you know, I know that, you know, probably day one, 50% of people will leave once we go to the market rents, right? So 50% right up the door, and then you start building up from there, I think is kind of what I did.
You'll have an initial group of people leave, and then you can stabilize. I'm not sure what percentage that will be, but it'll probably be above 30%, you know, and then you can do a marketing campaign that lets the other people know that, you know, you're still going to accept those lower rents, you know, up to a certain, just to let them know you're going to redo those lower rents to give you a chance to do the first 30% of the units. You know what I mean? And then move from there. So, and some of them will stay as long as they possibly can pay that lower rent. And then move
agreed.
Forward. Well, all right.
I think
so good luck with
that
really, one.
I think the one thing that really saves us on this one is after 2 years, the mortgage disappears. So at that point, the cash flow changes drastically.
Yeah. That would be really good.
Yeah, well, that's what we're trying to pull off. But all right, perfect. Thanks for your input, Dave.
Let me know how it's going.
I will let you know. Thanks.
All right. Okay. Getting near the top of the hour. Got some time for some more questions. Who's next?
Our next question comes from Darren. Darren, please state your question.
Hello, Dave. Happy belated birthday from San Antonio. San Antonio's popular today.
Yeah. How's it going down there?
Doing good. Now I know I got to bring you some dark chocolate next time. I didn't know you were into dark chocolate. Me too.
Hey, listen, here's the deal. You can mail it.
It's always better in person, but yeah, that's true. Because it could melt this time of the year.
That's what they have ice packs for.
That's true. That's a good point. Well, I'll keep that in mind. Did you have a good birthday yesterday?
Yeah, I did. I ate my way through it. I had lobster roll. I had a pint of mint chocolate chip ice cream. Ben and Jerry's mint chocolate chip ice cream is my favorite. I was only going to eat a little bit. Ate a pint. Had pizza from my favorite pizza place with the family. And then I had chocolate cake, cookies. I had all kinds of stuff. It was crazy. By the time I went to bed, I was food comatose. And I slept good.
Sounds like a good birthday.
Yeah, that's good.
Excellent. Well, I have a couple of questions, but first, just something for the guy who was just on about the low income housing. Sometimes, I know certainly down here in San Antonio, some of the low income housing are actually funded by more than one program. So you can actually have a higher, closer to market rent if you explore to see what other programs exist out there.
Oh, like switching the people over in transition?
Well, I mean, you know, like he was talking about transitioning people from the low income rent and transitioning new people that would pay market rent. But let's say that your low income rent is at 800 and you talk to the low income program and you talk to other low income programs and you talk to them about how you're repositioning the program. Sometimes they have the complex. Sometimes they have additional funds, because they want to keep people in a place where there's home, or there are other programs out there that they will team with to be able to pay more of the low-income tenants' rent. So you can actually, that's another possibility.
Okay, good point. Thank you for making that.
Yeah, and then my question was really more around figuring out your strategy for, you know, we all talk about exit strategies, and obviously it's very much has a lot of moving parts. It depends on, you know, what your tenant, what your investors want. For example, some of your investors want a long-term hold, some want a short-term hold. You may want a long-term hold or a short-term hold, and you're going to obviously try to pitch to investors that support that kind of model. But, and I know that if you have a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan, they have defeasance and other kinds of penalties if you try and refi before a certain date. So I'm trying to kind of figure my way around that and come out with my best concept as a, because this would be my, I have a fourplex, but I'm looking to start with, you know, obviously bigger units and trying to figure out my strategy and how to kind of figure out what would be the best strategy starting out.
So in terms of structuring the deal, the defeasance and yield maintenance really falls off around year five. So if you assume that you're going to hold something from years 5 to 7, that would help. Also, a lot of these, if you have to sell earlier, you get loans with assumptions, or you get in a loan that allows you to assume. So in case you do have to sell earlier, you're protected. And even in this market with these low interest rates, you know, it's going to be a good thing to have a loan that you can assume. So in terms of what were the other structure questions you had?
Well, it was really trying to figure out what's the best strategy, because I know, like, if you have a property that I think it's under $1.5 million, so a smaller property, you're pretty much obliged to go with a non-Fannie, non-Freddie, because I think it's only after $1.5 million that Fannie and Freddie kick in as their programs, right?
Yeah.
So that way, a smaller property, you could turn it around and refi it and cash out and move on to your next deal, keep it, or, you know, you could either refi, keep that cash invested in your next deal, or you could sell it, 1031 it. So I'm trying to, I mean, I guess I'm trying to just figure out what would be, there is no one strategy, but for someone starting out looking for, you know, 50 units and above, you know, is it, you know, how do you decide what's your strategy, your exit strategy?
Your exit strategy is going to be based on the value add that the property offers. Whether it be the market itself or whether it be low rents, low occupancy, higher expenses. So each deal is different and each market is a little bit different. So you've got to look at your exit strategies, you know, at the deal itself. So you start checking them off. Maybe condo conversion is an exit strategy. You know, maybe repositioning and flip is your exit strategy. So each one is going to be different. But if you're looking to grow, you know, the best thing to do is to get into a market and 1031 properties up. So, for instance, you buy 16 units and you hold it for a year or two in a good emerging market, and that will increase by one and a half, 150%. You take that equity and you 1031 it up to the next property, and now you own a 40 to 50 units. Hold that for a year or so, depending on how fast the market's going. And then you 1031 up, and now you're owning 150 unit property. And then the next one after that's like a $3 to $5 million property. And you've done it all by 1031 exchanging. So if you're starting small and looking to get big, certainly look at 1031 exchanges as an opportunity to do that and get there. So it's going to be dependent upon how the market's moving and how quickly it will rise. And you can ask the brokers about the historical market cycles of a particular city, you know, how long they typically last, where, you know, how they go through the sub-markets. Typically, the downtown area will move first, and then you have another area will move second, third, fourth, and fifth. You always want to stay like one or two steps ahead where the market's, you know, nobody's really excited about that particular part of the market right now, and that's where you get your best pricing. So that's another strategy to use. So in terms of starting smaller and getting bigger, those are the different things I would do. I would look at 1031 exchanging forward. Look for nice repositioning deals where you can reposition up, and you can 1031 exchange a repositioning deal as well. Also, if you want to start bigger, micro repositioning deals that you go in and you buy a B property in a B neighborhood in a good emerging market, and you basically just change the cosmetics of the property, you know, the landscaping, the parking, the signage, don't change the name. A property that is usually about it. 88 to 90% of what the market is, and the market's usually in these markets about 93-94%. So it's a property that's slipping down, but it hasn't gone below 85%. You're upgrading the common areas. Nothing, no major repairs. Anywhere from $1,500 to $2,500 per unit. And on those properties, you can refinance them out in 18 months and get a big pop. You could, if you structure it properly, you could refinance your investors out completely if they come in at debt partners, and now it's just you and the bank that owns the property. So there's a lot of different ways to go after it. I think the best – who's your coach?
Well, I'm actually not in the mastery program completely yet. I'm doing it bit by bit. So.
Oh, all right. I was going to tell you to talk to your coach and have him go through what your goals are, because it's really going to be dependent upon what your goals are. You know, where
right.
you want to be in, say, 3 or 5 years from now. And then that will be, you know, that will also help you determine your strategy.
Gotcha. Perfect. Thank you very much for the answers. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Send that chocolate.
I will do.
I'm just kidding. Come up and visit us sometime, though, at the office.
How dark do you like it?
Nothing more than 70%. I'm like
more
52
than 70,
to 70%
okay.
guy. Yeah, I
gotcha.
Don't like it dark. I like it to be a little bit sweet.
There you go. All right. Yeah, it's kind of like wine chocolate. You know, we all have our little niche in there. So.
Yeah, I don't like anything inside my dark chocolate except peppermint, which is kind of weird.
You're a mint guy. I like mint too.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. That's
nice.
Have you tried Ben & Jerry's mint chocolate chip ice cream?
I have. I love it.
Yeah. You can only get it at a Ben & Jerry's store. They don't sell those in the supermarket. You have to actually go to the store to get it. But
yeah,
I've only ever had it at the
airport before, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
They have a Ben & Jerry's in Denver at the airport. Good talking to you. Thank you. Take care.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
All right, who's next? We got a little time. It's 2 o'clock, but we can go a little bit longer. Who's next?
Up next, we have Brian. Brian, please state your question.
Hey, Dave, it's Brian Adams. I heard you in the beginning giving me a high five, so I certainly appreciate it.
Hey, all right, good. Let me go back to that. I didn't know you. Did I say your name was Brian Adams? Because I would have made some sort of a joke about that, you know.
Yes, it is. I cut like a knife. Everything I do for I do for you.
how's life been living with the name Brian Adams?
You know, it's in some regards it's a good icebreaker. But I was at a networking event and it was a younger crowd, and I said something like I just told you, and I had like blank stares looking at me, like, you know, some 20-year-olds, like, who the heck is Brian Adams and why are you making a stupid joke?
He hasn't been around in a long time, but he's got classic songs from the 80s, that's for sure.
Yes, he does.
You know what, too? I think he was wasn't he the one that did a concert in five continents in one day? Didn't he do that? It's like a Guinness Book of World Records. He went in, did a half an hour, got on a plane, flew something to another continent, did a half an hour got at the airport, got on the plane, and got himself in the Guinness Book of World Record.
Yeah,
I believe he did
that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure myself. So yeah.
All right. So when I started this call, I said that your first deal was 276 units for $4.5 million, and then you did 144 units in South Carolina for 10.3. And then your next deal was 209 units for $6 million that appraised for 7.4, and you just purchased a 556 unit deal for $10 million. You raised $10 million in 45 days. All correct?
Yeah.
All that's correct. Yes.
Yeah, add two deals to that, but 240 and a 200 unit deal that I bought last year as well.
Wow, great. So I'm gonna ask you some questions on the front end that some of the people listening would want to know, like how you got started, how you get into that first deal. I'm going to ask you some questions on the back end, is how'd you do that $10 million raise in 45 days? So how did you get into that first deal, that first big deal?
Well, I think it's you've brought it up before. It's all about relationships. It's who do we have in our networks that maybe are in a place that we all desire to get to. So I'll just give a quick snapshot. My background is a CPA with real estate taxation, forensic accounting. I was working the grind. I was working, you know, all these hours, and I knew that I just didn't want to be the CPA anymore. I wanted to get to another place. So I, you know, through some of your teachings and the networks that we're all in, I guess, I sought someone out that was ahead of me, if you will, and was able to add value. And that value was able to raise capital for that opportunity. I wasn't one who found the deal. I wasn't the operator. I wasn't the loan sponsor either, but I was able to, I guess, lend a hand, if you will, get myself in an opportunity to learn, sit in the back seat, if you will, ask those important questions. And then upon the refinance that would happen, myself and my investors got cashed out. And it's a great story. I was able then to leverage that story to my own investor database. I was able to then, you know, kind of slingshot ahead of maybe some of the other competitors that were, you know, climbing the same ladder that I was, but I was just able to, you know, kind of look at things a little bit differently. And then that helped slingshot me in, like I said before, to, you know, get into my own deals and kind of structure my own opportunities.
So in terms of getting into your own deals, the broker relationships, how long did it take to establish a relationship with the broker that gave you your first deal?
You know, it takes time. I think often people get into this and think overnight, hey, they're going to get capital and they're going to get a deal. But it doesn't work that way. You need to create some relationship, some commonality. And I know you've touched on it on many times of your training. You need, maybe it's just not business. Maybe it's children. Maybe it's golf. Maybe it's, you know, that you ran a triathlon. You know, some of all these other connection pieces. And sometimes what I do personally is I don't call a broker to say, hey, do you got any pocket listings for me? I may call that person out of the blue and say, hey, you know, John or whoever, how are you doing today? How are your kids? Hey, Michigan State was playing over the weekend. I saw they lost, you know, that type of thing. Sorry, bummer, you know, that type of stuff. And what happens is they'll start thinking about you. And what I also do is I, you know, kind of put some things in my CRM system so that, you know, I have touch points. So, hey, 30 days go by. Hey, I got to reach out to so-and-so. Just want to say hello and, you know, create a genuine relationship. It's nothing kind of, you know, slithery or anything like that. It's a genuine connection with someone that then they say, wow, this guy is, you know, he's sincere. And, hey, maybe I'll kick him a deal and see what he does with it.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly how it's done. Thank you for taking everybody step by step through that. And, you know, I'd like to say sometimes, you know, for some relationships it happens fast and for others it takes a little bit longer. But when you find that commonality, when you find that peace where you sincerely have something in common with the other person and you call them up to talk about just that and not business, you're right. That's when you become a piece of their mind and they start thinking about you.
This I agree.
Good. So now let's go into the $10 million raise. So how are you raising money for all your deals? How much do you think you've raised total for all of your deals?
I'm over about 21 mil. And I got it's funny because I bought a 240 unit deal last year for $9.4 million, and I'm selling it next month and for $13.250. And I've got that $3 million of capital raised plus another $7 million that people are saying, where are your deals? And I just, you know, I'm very methodical. I have my background against the CPA, so I'm looking for the right deals, you know, 200-plus value-add deals. And as you probably know yourself, I mean, there's a lot of competition, a lot of crazy money out there that are buying on, you know, some sick pro formas and silliness. But to come back to your question, and it comes back to the overall, you know, what we're talking about, it's all about relationships. Raising $10 million in 45 days did not happen overnight. It's, you know, I look at it this way. There's a lot of determination and discipline and desire, and you got to just be diligent and you just got to be, you know, someone that's, again, creating that genuine relationship so that when a deal or opportunity comes, you know, we've checked the boxes. We've dotted the I's and crossed the T's. That's what investors look into us for. We're the operator. We're responsibility. We have a fiduciary responsibility, I should say, of a lot of money at stake. You know, if someone's not investing 20 bucks, right? They're not buying a $20 widget. Some, in my minimum, is 100,000. So that's a lot of money that someone that we, you know, first meet, they're not going to give you that money like you're talking at UP9. You're going to meet these people. They're not going to give you dollars. They're not going to open their checkbook at the event, and nor should they, you know, because you got to do the pre-existing relationship, all that good stuff. But that being said, what does someone do when you first meet with someone? Well, put them in your database. You know, send them an email, send them a thank you note, handwritten. You know, send them an article of whatever information that topic might be, so that you can then create, you know, the long-term relationship or the long-term play to eventually when that deal is presented. I was able to fund it in 45 days, which was, I was like, that's awesome. That's pretty cool.
That's great. So where do you go in order to start these, establish these relationships? Where are your favorite places to meet these people?
Well, I don't do anything now. I hate to say it that way because hard work. Yeah, when I first started, yeah, I'd say it that way. My background is, again, I said it before, a CPA. So I come at some of the angles of dealing with high net worth. You know, I was advising, you know, folks that were in the net worth range of, you know, 50 million to 75 million. I'm not saying that to impress your audience, but I'm used to those types of conversations of people sharing, you know, some very sensitive information. I knew how much people made, so I was comfortable in those conversations already. So when I was first starting, I would just basically think to myself, okay, everyone's going to the local RIA. You know, everyone's probably there to looking for capital. I would go to certain events. I think, Dave, when I started with you back in back in like 2008, I think you brought this up, or 2009, is go to a place where no one else is that local real estate expert. So I did. I went to, you know, the wine and cheese event. I went to the Mercedes dealership one night. They were having, you know, some event, you know, about their cars. And was there another real estate professional there? No. Did I raise any capital from that event? No. But it was just me kind of getting out there to, you know, just kind of get the name known and then working on your pitch and your, hey, you know, how are you going to approach, you know, a relationship? So what was good for me, because at the end of 2011, I quit my CPA job. I burned all the bridges behind me. As you know, I think you're a big Tony Robbins guy as well. I burned everything behind me. I pushed the chips in. I started my business. And I woke up, you know, the beginning of 2012 with that thought, I'm either self-employed or unemployed. I really need to bust my ass to, you know, kind of make some things happen. I was trying to buy some multifamily. It didn't work out. So I had to change strategy. I was flipping houses. I was doing about 1 to 2 houses a month, Dave. And honestly, when I look back and I take the reflection period, that was probably the best thing for me, because when an investor was, you know, sending me $100K and we dot the I's and cross the T's, you know, all the paperwork, But I showed that investor that, hey, I got your money. I'm going to do exactly what I say I'm going to do, and I'm going to give your money back plus a yield of return. Well, what does that investor do? He was very active in his church and, you know, just an overall just good guy. So then he told his friend, and then his friend told his friend, and it just snowballs. So the moral of the whole story here, I guess, is, you know, treat people right, say exactly what you're going to do. And if you run into snags, it's not all rosy here, right? We all know that. If you run into some snags, you got to be transparent. You got to communicate often. And you got to be able to, you got to step up and say, hey, things aren't happening the way I thought it was going to happen. And here are the reasons why. Here is my plan to get us from here to there. Because, you know, I've had a fire at my property. I've had gangs. I've had prostitution and drugs. You know, those things pop up. And we got to have strategy. You got to have effective management to help us, you know, kind of, you know, basically formulate the plan and as well as execute the strategy.
And open communication to your investors is key when things like that happen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
because if it does all go wrong, at least you're communicating with them and you're working with them and, you know, you're taking their input, but they know what's happening. Instead of, a lot of investors make the mistake of, if something's not going right, they don't tell their investors because they think they can fix it before they tell them, you know, and then it goes a little bit worse and then they hold off because, you know, they think they can fix that and all of a sudden it's really bad, and you know, when they tell the investors are all pissed off. It's like, why didn't you tell us before? You know, and a lot of times one of the investors has a solution as well. So open communication is really key.
Yeah,
Dan,
go
ahead.
I'm sorry. I know there's a little bit of delay. I didn't want to speak over you, but just to go off that point just real quickly is, what does the investor expect when they, you know, get the PPM, they sign off on the deal? They expect the good. And I think we all need to be disciplined as an operator or sponsor and say, hey, you know, we have some bad here, and I got to man up and say, this is the bad, and it's not all going to be rosy here, and here's how we're going to fix it. An investor doesn't want to, you know, put money in where they're with someone that they just don't have a plan. If they don't have a plan, it's going to be bad news for all parties involved.
You know what my favorite question is from an investor when I'm raising funds is, what's the worst thing that could happen to this deal? And I'll look that investor straight in the eye and I'll say, the tenants don't pay rent, we can't pay the mortgage, and we get foreclosed on. And then they just look at you like, wow, you know, that was like the absolute truth. And from that point forward, they trust you even more because you just told them the
right,
absolute worst case that could happen to a property. And you told them, you know, you didn't try to sugarcoat anything. So I love
that
question. The other question I get, and it makes me crazy, though, is the very first investor call that we have when we own a property, there's always somebody on the line that says, do you think we're going to hit those returns? And I typically say, well, since this is day two, we're on track. what else are you going to say?
Right, right.
But you've done some really good stuff. What, give some advice. You know, this is a surprise that you actually heard me call you out, so I appreciate you calling in. So give some advice.
Well, you've
to
got
people that are,
I
got to
plug
starting.
I got to plug your staff real quick, Dave. You know, Jeannie's just awesome. So she and I have communicated, and I just happened to punch in and heard you giving me the high five, and so you've got some good players around you. So I know you built that, and I know you're supportive of your team. So I just want to give Jeannie a plug as well.
Oh, awesome. So give some advice to, and Jeannie does work out, Jermaine's over there as well in the mastery program, my brother Jeff is as well, and the whole staff here, we're all hard workers.
Yep.
But give some advice to somebody who's listening in, thinking about it, or somebody else in mastery that is just getting started, and, you know, give some beginning advice.
Some beginning advice. Well, I think it's really important that as your mastery students kind of sit down after this call or whenever they listen to it, is they really need to get dialed in on their why and create an emotional relationship with that why. Because as you know, in this business, it's not always fun. There's challenges, there's risks, there's people like investors calling you about returns, and you know, there's problems. So you need to kind of get connected with, why are you doing this? And if you're leaving your 9-to-5 job, that was my juice. At the time, my girls were 4 and 2, and I was working all these hours and, you know, not seeing them or my wife. And that gave me my passion or my juice to stay up late and get up really early in the morning and crank through deals and make investor calls and follow up with brokers. And, you know, it's a lot of hard work here. So, you just need to kind of get connected with your why, because that's going to give you the emotional, I guess, juice to keep you forward. And then I always come back to ABM. And to me, that means always be marketing, always telling someone about yourself and what you're able, what benefit that you can provide to them, because that's what it's all about. No one's going to give you money if I'm solely looking at myself and how I'm going to be prosperous. Well, that's the wrong approach. You need to kind of create that win-win strategy. How is that investor going to be prosperous working with you? And on that flip side, how is the broker going to be prosperous? Obviously, if you can close the deal, they're going to get their commission. So you're going to be, you know, you just want to continue to be top of mind. And we're all busy. And so I'll leave it on this, is that we need to carve out time. As for those that are just getting started, you need to carve out time on either weekly. Well, I look at it this way. If you have a goal of, you know, whatever cash flow that is on a monthly basis, well, you need to carve out time. You've got to be disciplined to carve out time on a weekly basis, daily basis, and hourly basis. You want to kind of keep track of your own schedule. If you're working 9 to 5, well, how are you going to get the work done? You know, is it going to be getting up early? Is it going to be taking no lunch? Or is it maybe not watching football on a weekend and, you know, making postcards or leveraging other people's skill sets to help you get where you want to go, all kind of centered and aligned with your own why and your passion?
That's good advice. And, you know, we never say that this is an easy business. And I think one of the things we've always been honest about is that this business is work. It takes work to get financially free. It takes work to be able to wake up one morning and to be able to follow your passions for the rest of your life. But what we do know is that if you will do what most people won't do for 3 to 5 years, because that's really all it takes, you will be able to do for the rest of your life what most people can't. So yes, it is work, but that hard work doesn't, like you said, you know, how did you raise $10 million in 45 days? Well, it was easy because you already did the hard work, you know,
right.
years before. So, hey, I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, Dave, you should put that on a t-shirt, because what you just said, it's totally legit. Everyone that's listening, just buy into what Dave just told you and put in the hard work, roll up sleeves, get dirty, get muddy. It can happen with the determination. So thank you, Dave. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. And hope to see you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks.
All right. So I just want to reiterate one more thing. If you're interested in any of the offers that we had at the Ultimate Partnering 9, and if you're thinking about going to Ultimate Partnering 2018, there's a special offer on DaveCall.com, DaveCall.com. So for you mastery students, you know what the deal is. You got to go out there and get yourself into two different offer situations. You got to put in two offers a week, get into two networking situations for some private funds. If you just simply do two and two, you cannot help but be successful. Oh, by the way, if anybody has any questions regarding anything, call the office, 781-878-7114. That's 781-878-7114. We're here in Eastern Time. All right. Bye, everybody. Come on. Let me show you Alex. Alex is the guy that makes this thing all possible, with Tyler in the other room as well. There he is.
Hello.
Yeah, he's the one that's going to come in and shut it all down as well. So thanks, everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks.